Hi, John.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Just dandy.
Good. Can you see me clearly, by the way, John?
Yes, I can.
Good. I wanted to check on that.
Nose.
Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Hits TV. You're John Judas, well-known writer for the New Republic, author of a number of books, including a highly regarded biography of William F. Buckley, and a book, what was it, The Paradox of American Democracy?
Yes.
Yes, and others, too, right? Including... just published, hot off the presses, Genesis, Truman, American Jews, and the Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, by the published by the estimable publishing house Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. That's a very prestigious imprint there, John.
I'm glad you think so. That's
known. It's known.
Yeah.
It's a known fact. So, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Why did you write it?
Well, that's a difficult question. It's I had been thinking about the subject for a long time. You want me to go back and give you the whole evolution of how I got there? I'm not sure.
First, let's tell people, give them a sense of where you got by answering this question. What was it that you thought was not sufficiently understood about Truman's role in the creation of Israel and in that period generally that you wanted to highlight?
That's not the way I would go about answering your question. Here's the way I would answer it. I was thinking about writing a book about U.S. and Israel. I'd been interested in the subject for a long time. I'd been somewhat frustrated because I couldn't express the ideas I had on the magazine I worked for, so I did it somewhat elsewhere. I had always been a dove on the subject.
Although we should note that it was under previous ownership that you could not express yourself on the issue, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
And so I thought about doing a book, and I had a discussion with a friend about it. And he said, well, you know, you should do an argument about what you think should happen. And I said, well, the problem with that is that you get into this kind of he said, she said dynamic if you talk just about the present. You get into this thing, who fired the rocket before the assassination occurred? Who really screwed up Camp David in 2000? Who started the Second Intifada? And I wanted to avoid that. So I thought the way to avoid that was to do history. And I thought that I could see a lot of the problems that had occurred since, which to me consisted of the United States intervening, but intervening ineffectively in trying to resolve the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians. If I looked at the beginning, and the beginning, as far as the U.S. is concerned, are the Truman years. So I didn't have a preconception as I went back and looked at those years that I would find something special. I mean, I was looking for something, but I was more, I went into it more or less blind.
And then what did you find?
Well, let me say one other thing about it. What I found was, after a while, was that it was impossible just to write about the Truman years. And the reason was especially from the perspective now, if you look at those years, the Nazis, the Holocaust, the Final Solution just overshadow everything morally speaking. And you really can't understand at all why the Arabs were so angry, either then, before that, or now. And to see that side of the question, you really have to go back farther. And you have to go back at least, I think, to the 1890s, 1880s, to the beginning of Zionism and the beginning of the emigration to Palestine, to understand for them what the issue was. I'm not saying that that's the only issue, but to understand that side of it, you can't just do 1945 to 1948. So I ended up doing a book that starts earlier, but climaxes in the Truman years.
Yes, there is a lot of pre-Truman history here. There is a kind of a short history of Zionism in the book.
Right.
Okay, so now that we know all that, what did you find about the Truman period that was interesting?
Well, what I found, let me say it this way: what I found was that if you look at most of the books about Truman and Israel, I won't say all, but a lot of them end in on May 14th, 1948, when he recognizes Israel. Mm-hmm. And what follows usually is a kind of triumphant summary of what he did and what he accomplished, as seen by his own eyes later, but 5-10 years in his memoirs, where he saw it as a remarkable achievement by himself that he had participated in the recognition of this state. But what I discovered when I looked at the papers, when I went to Independence and went through his Truman papers, was that he had extraordinary misgivings about what he was doing. And he, even the next day in letters on May 15th, he was expressing that, in fact, he'd wished it turned out another way, which is the way that he had first seen of a state that was neither Arab nor Jewish. He wanted some kind of binational arrangement, some kind of federation. And he continued expressing those misgivings for the next 6 months. I tell a story in the very beginning of the book of when the Jewish war veterans go to visit him in the White House in September 1948. And he thinks it's going to be a very routine, one of these things where they come in, shake hands, and ask him to appear at an event. But instead, what happens is they read off a whole list to him of grievances and things that he should do for the new state of Israel. And he gets mad. He says, I'm the best friend that the Jewish people ever had. But in fact, if I'd had my way, we would have done things a lot differently. We would have done things the way that Bevin, the British foreign secretary, and I had laid out in 1946, which was this kind of federation. And the reason we couldn't do that was because of he has various people he blamed for it, mm-hmm. but he usually blames the emotional Jews, the Arabs, sometimes the British, a long litany. But the point is that he had misgivings about what he was doing well into 6 months afterwards. So that struck me, and I looked back and I wanted to see why he did, what his thought was, and. I mean, I think that was the first thing that really struck me about Truman.
So he would have preferred something like what we now call a one-state solution? I mean, you're talking about a sovereign federated state, or are you talking about something that would have continued to be under British rule but autonomous, or what?
Well, the thing, Truman didn't have an exact idea of what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up, he sent a guy named Grady over there to deal with the British, and he consulted with him daily, and they came out with a plan that would be a federated single state, two autonomous districts, British still controlling foreign affairs and things like that, mm-hmm. until such a time as the two sides could get together. And there would be a joint legislature. It would be a kind of way that, of easing out the British, but it and the end result would be a state where the two parties could get along. Okay. Now, I have to tell you, I'm not making an argument here for a one-state solution now. That's not what struck me about it. In fact, I think at the time it wasn't feasible.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have only been feasible, any kind of deal like that, If the United States had been willing to send troops, and maybe send troops for 10, 15, 20 years, and maybe it wouldn't have worked then, because the two sides really were not ready to get together, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
So it was not I don't think it was a practical solution. But what interested me was why Truman did that, why Truman thought that. And the two reasons he thought that were, first, moral. He was a Jeffersonian. He believed that people should get along. He didn't like the idea of an exclusively Jewish or an exclusively Arab state. It wasn't that he wasn't an Arabist. He didn't want the Arabs to control everything. He didn't like the idea of a single people or a single religion dominating a state, especially mm-hmm. at the expense of another people. So he wanted some kind of arrangement that was fair. The second thing was that he feared that if something other than that occurred, if you had a Jewish state, if the Jews took over most of it, or the Arabs did, you could have 50, 60 years of war, riot, and rebellion, which is in fact what pretty much has occurred. So he had a moral and a geopolitical reason, and I think both of them are worth respecting. I think that the moral reason would lead us now to try to get some kind of an arrangement that's fair to the Arabs as well as the Jews. And the other one would give us some urgency about trying to make a deal in the first place, because it's not in our interest as Americans to have this source of constant instability in the Middle East. So that's my take on Truman.
And there was skepticism about the solution he settled on from in some parts of his administration as well, right? Although there was support for it in some parts of his administration, right? I mean, there was division among his advisors.
Within the White House, he had strong support, especially from the political people and from a guy named David Niles, who was his liaison to labor, civil rights, and the Jewish community, and who was very close to the Jewish Agency, which was the relevant body at that time before there was a government of Israel. So within the White House itself, there was considerable support. State Department, I'd say that there was overwhelming opposition. Not so much to, again, what they wanted was neither Jewish nor Arab. And their standpoint wasn't any more realistic, practically speaking, than Truman's, because what they wanted was indefinite control by the British. Mm-hmm. And the British, by this point, had come out of World War II decimated. They just couldn't afford to keep a foreign army in foreign occupations. They'd pull out of India, and they wanted desperately to get out of Palestine. And the State Department kept sending envoys over there to convince them to stay, and they kept saying no, and we just wouldn't take, we wouldn't believe them. We kept, so the State Department, yes, they had a moral dimension too to their thought. They were worried also about being fair, but they were also worried that that turmoil would lead to the Soviet Union establishing a foothold in the Middle East.
And would swing Arab sympathy toward the Soviet Union, right?
That's correct, right.
And then General George Marshall pretty firmly opposed the creation of Israel as we know it, right?
I wouldn't say that. The first thing about it, it's, you know, when you think about it, you think of Truman and Marshall and all these people as being really obsessed with what to do about Israel. But in fact, they were thinking about the Cold War. Truman was thinking about election. They were it was very much a side issue for them.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a very funny scene in I think it's May 12th, 1948. There's this great meeting where they a showdown meeting about whether they should recognize Israel, this new state of Israel. And it's Marshall, Lovett, who's his undersecretary, pretty much versus Clark Clifford and a few hangers on. But that's the lineup, and they're fighting it out. And in the middle of this, one of them gets a call that these emissaries from the Jewish Agency had gone back to Palestine. This is before there's Israel. And they had met with this guy named David Ben-Gurion, who was, of course, the leader of the Jewish Agency and soon to be the head of the State of Israel. And he had had expectations of some kind of what the U.S. was going to do. And Marshall's response was, "Who's David Ben-Gurion?" So I think that gives you a sense of the fact that they were not engaged. And to a great extent, Marshall and Lovett were both deferring to people in the Near East Bureau who mm-hmm. were more expert on the issue. Mm-hmm. So that's Marshall too was willing to compromise at the end. I think what he really resented was the idea that the decision was being driven by politics. I think that bothered him more than anything. And by then, by the middle of May, he was extremely pissed off at Clark Clifford, who he thought was at the source of this kind of pressure that was building up to do something, not for geopolitical, but purely for political reasons.
And is that your assessment? It was ultimately just a political calculation?
Well, my assessment was that it would have happened. There might have been a delay. Truman did it at the moment he did it. He did it like, I don't know, it was like 10 minutes after Israel pronounced itself a state, which is usually our government spends, you know, a few days or something. He did it then because there were rallies planned that night by the Zionist organizations all over the country that were going to denounce him if he didn't do it. And he was very worried about it. It was 1948. Election was coming up. So in that sense, he did it at that moment for political reasons. I think he would have done it anyway, because they really had very little choice at that point.
And how important was American endorsement? I mean, the state, was it really decisive? What would have happened if America had not recognized Israel?
I'm not sure. There still would have been a war. I think America was not supplying arms to Israel. The Czechs were one of the major suppliers. So I don't think it would have changed the outcome of the war. Obviously, it made things easier for the Israelis. But again, it's a kind of counterfactual that, if it didn't happen on May 14th, it would have happened on May 25th. Or on June 7th. It's not like there was any alternative. Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the domestic political pressure, there's kind of a paradox because on the one hand, there was domestic political support for recognizing Israel that Truman apparently felt was persuasive. But there was also domestic opposition to actually letting many Jews come to America, right? And a lot of the pressure for the creation state of Israel was the fact that there were all these displaced Jews in basically refugee camps, right? I mean, they had to go, the thinking was they had to go somewhere. And apparently the American domestic, political space wasn't amenable to them coming to America. And maybe it's not a paradox, I guess, if they don't come to America, then they go to Israel instead. But I mean, in other words, one force seems sympathetic to the Jews and one doesn't.
Well, let me back up a little. If you look at the history of what happens in Palestine from 1880 to, let's say, 1925, it's very hard to find any justification for Zionists going there and trying to establish a Jewish state where another people made up 90 to 95% of the population and had lived there for 1,300 years. It's something that at the time was justified for reasons that we wouldn't respect now, bringing civilization to barbarians and stuff like that. But if you look at what happens in 1920s and 1930s, the picture changes because first you get the closing off of immigration to the United States and the rest of the West in the 1920s and early 1930s. Before that, if Jews suffered violent repression in Russia and the Pale of Settlement, they could go to the United States. And I was trying to look for the other figures, but it's, millions and millions went to the United States and thousands went to Palestine. Mm-hmm. But after that, after it's closed off, Palestine really becomes the only refuge. And then what happens is the rise of the Nazis, which is not just in Germany, but they inspire all these, not anti-Semitic parties in Central and Eastern Europe. So it's right at that point that Palestine becomes the only recourse as far as a lot of Jews in Europe see it. And so you do at that point have competing moral claims between the Jews on the one hand and the Arabs on the other. It's just that what I wanted, again, the reason I went back to the 1880s was that in order to understand why the Arabs were so angry, you really do have to look at this country that was 95% Arab, Christian, and Muslim, and people coming not just to emigrate, which is one thing. It's not like, the Irish coming to the United States. It's more like the Irish coming to the United States to try to create an Irish state. That's what was happening. And that's something that upset them terribly and, led to wars and riots and stuff for 100 years. So that's the – anyway, the immigration thing is extremely important. And Truman, to his credit, tried to do something about it, because his standpoint was he was extraordinarily sympathetic to the refugees in Europe from the extermination camps and from the Nazis. And he wanted them to be able to go to Palestine. The British didn't want to let them in because they didn't want to inflame the Arabs. But Truman saw that as a way of, in fact, avoiding having a Jewish state, because it would be a kind of a safety valve. It would allow the pressure to decrease. I'm not saying this was extraordinary logic, but that's the way he thought of it at the time. Bevin, the foreign minister, says, well, why should we let them in when you won't let them into the United States? So Truman does try a bill, but it just gets completely screwed up because, as you say, there was opposition not just to immigrants, but to Jewish immigrants in particular. Mm-hmm. So, yes, that was a problem.
Yeah. So it's not like you – it sounds like it's not like you think there was something way, way better that realistically could have been done at the time, right? I mean, obviously the aftermath has been in some ways problematic, but it's not like you see an obviously – preferable solution
in the Truman period. There wasn't a slight opening in the period around the fall of 1946 and early 1947, where the British were starting to get somewhere with bringing the Jews and the Arabs to some kind of agreement that might have given them like 10 more years to establish a state, and the British would stay there. But it just was nothing came together at that point. And really, the only way that it could have worked would have been as with an international force there to keep the sides apart. And the only way that could have worked was with the United States, because at that point, United States was the only armed force that was willing to do that. I mean, was able to do that kind of thing. The Russians might have come in, but we were scared to death of letting the Russians in the Middle East. So
So you sound reasonably dispassionate in talking about this, and you sound reasonably even-handed. But the book has gotten a certain amount of blowback from the right. Right. I mean, it's actually early days. The book it's not been out for very long. But am I overreading things to say that there's been a little blowback from the right?
I couldn't even bear to read this thing in the Wall Street Journal. But people send me little excerpts of it. And somebody, I gave a talk last night, and somebody said that they read three reviews that accused me of not mentioning the Hebron massacre in 1929, and then they'd gone and looked at my book, and it was like, you know, it was well included. So I've gotten a lot
what the guy in the Journal said about that, the massacre in Hebron, was that you seemed more forgiving of that than of comparable Jewish crimes against Arabs or something. I don't know. That was his line. I mean, it was a strange review. Do you want to hear another excerpt?
It might be too painful. What?
Well, this is the very ending of the review. Near the end, he, that's you, quotes a saying of Jesus: "For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" And castigates Israel's Jews. This is you doing the castigating, apparently. And castigates Israel's Jews for having, quote, gained a world of their own, but at the expense of another people, end quote. An author who brandishes his liberal commitments at every turn ends up invoking a Christian teaching on greed to condemn the Jews for sacrificing another people at the altar of their own interest. That's the resonant ending. Which I thought was a slightly tendentious reading of what you.
I describe Jesus. I'm a Reza Aslan guy. I mean, you once told me that he's popularized an existing view of Jesus, but I very much endorse.
As he says himself, basically, he knows that the view of Jesus predates his book. But yeah, he wrote the book Zealot.
I see Jesus as the last of the great Jewish prophets. I don't see him as somebody who is antithetical to Judaism, and I think that what he said does fit the situation, which is to say that the Jews got what they wanted. The Arabs got screwed. The Arabs wanted self-determination as a people. First, they end up under the rule of Jordan and Egypt. In Jordan, after 1948, the king says that Palestine can't, the word Palestine can't appear in textbooks. After 1967, they become a colonized people. So that's what I was saying. And my whole view is that there is a part of the Jewish ethical tradition that I identify with that sees Jews as being committed to the rights not only of their own people but other people. And I would wish that that Jewish Americans and other Americans would see it the same way in Israel and the West Bank right now.
There have been actually more favorable reviews. There's a review in the Toronto Globe and Mail that we can link to as well. And then there was a review in the American Prospect by Gershom Gorenberg, who's an Israeli, an American-born Israeli kind of liberal Zionist, that was largely sympathetic, I would say. He did. Now, I know you make a habit of just not reading reviews of your books more or less, right? So maybe I'm going to have to tell you what his one criticism...
Absolutely favorable.
What?
I might read him in months, but, you know, I get too nervous about this.
It was a pretty favorable review, but he did, and I don't totally understand this criticism, but it was that you kind of forced Jewish history into an American frame which sees the Jewish people as fundamentally a religious group, and he's kind of arguing that even before Zionism, there was, to some extent, there was at least a strand of kind of nationalist thinking about Jewish identity. And I'm not sure exactly how he thinks that may muddy your analysis or anything. But does that make any sense to you?
No.
So do you disagree that there was much in the way of a pre-Zionist Jewish nationalism?
There was always two strains of, there wasn't always, but in the 19th century, there were two different ideas of Judaism that reflected the two different experiences. Germany, France, Great Britain, the emigres to the United States did want to think of themselves as primarily members of a religious group. And that's because also they wanted the same rights as other religious groups. They wanted to be, in that sense, a denomination. Mm-hmm. The Jews who were ghettoized in Poland, parts of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, but especially this Pale of Settlement that ran along the eastern edge of the eastern or the western edge? Well, the western edge of the Soviet Empire. Did think of themselves as a people because they were, in that sense, not simply a religious group. They were segregated. There were all kinds of laws passed against them. They couldn't own certain kinds of property, things like that. So it did reflect the actual experience. And in America, what happens is that you get in the 19th century, you get the German emigres all having this view of Judaism as a religion. Then you get the Eastern Europeans coming, starting in the 1880s, who have a much different view. And that's in the book. It's not. There is a difference.
Well, don't accept my characterization of what he wrote because I may have it slightly wrong. I mean, he. But at some point you should get around to reading the review. It's actually a good. It's very well written, and I think captures a certain amount of the narrative in your book in very concise form and.
I have a lot of respect for Gershom. It's just my own peculiarity that I haven't read it.
Now, in your kind of in the history of Zionism part, you draw attention to kind of more complexity in the landscape of Zionism than people may realize. There was more than one kind of Zionist, and in the end, a certain variant of Zionism won out. Right?
Yes, that's right.
What's the underappreciated? I mean, you talk about like cultural Zionists. What is a cultural Zionist?
Well, the one person that I spent a lot of time trying talking about because he had a lot of people who then tried to follow in his footsteps was Ahad Haim, who came out of Odessa, and who was 1880s. He was a leader of the Zionist movement, and he did not so much support a Jewish state, but Palestine as becoming a kind of Vatican for the Jews, establishing a cultural center there that would radiate outwards. Something that the rest of the Jews in the world could see as a religious cultural center. The people who follow in his footsteps, like Judah Magnus, an American who emigrates to Palestine in the 1920s and is one of the founders of the Hebrew University, become the advocates of a binational state. And they're the ones also who say that we have to treat the Arabs equally. We can't. We have to get some kind of arrangement that's fair to both sides. So he's one. He's a neglected side of Zionist history. The best known is Theodore Herzl, and Theodore Herzl is a political Zionist, and he very much wants to see Zionism establishing a kind of junior partner to Western imperialism in Palestine. He wants to, in effect, buy off the Ottoman Empire to get the Turks to agree to the Jews to take over Palestine. Then he tries to get the British to cede part of the Sinai. That vision of Zionism is very prevalent in the United States. The first Zionists are followers of Herzl, not Ahad Haim. Mm-hmm. There's some other varieties we could talk about. The Chaim Weizmann, who is the great diplomat of Zionism, combines the two in some way. But in the end, they all come out in favor of a Jewish state. And it's only this dissenting group that, you know, to some extent still exists. In the 1930s and 1940s, there was a group of them, and they include a lot of people who are very well known. Martin Buber, Hannah Arendt, Albert Einstein, who advocated this kind of solution. But they
advocated which kind? You mean a binational state?
Yes.
So basically they were one state solution people.
At that time, yes. Uh-huh. But they had no support among the Jews, and the Arabs didn't take them seriously. So, you know, it was a fringe position.
Well, it was also the question of how the Arabs would have responded to that, whether that would have been viable in the end.
Yes, absolutely. Because basically with the Arabs, you start having these major uprisings in 1929, and then there's a war that starts that goes through most of the 1930s, where the Arabs just get brutally repressed, and Rashid Khalidi uses the word, they become envenomed. And it's from that point that it's really hard to see any solution. It's the British actually who do most of the repressing. Hmm. But the leaders at that point in Palestine, the Mufti, various people around him, the kind of thing they were advocating was that only Jews who came before World War I and their children be allowed in the country. They weren't talking about allowing anybody else to emigrate. They wanted to kick out large numbers of Jews from Palestine. So you can't imagine very much of a compromise between that standpoint and whatever the Jewish agency proposed.
So you're not, this isn't one of those books that's making the argument that, well, if only this had been different at this period in history, everything else would be different in some predictable and better way.
Absolutely not. I'm not making that argument. My argument is, if there's a lesson to be drawn, it's for the present, and that we have to understand, and going back to Jesus, that the Arabs have never had the just injustices done to them fully recognized and redressed, and that we have to do that in terms of our negotiating, in terms of what we're trying to intervene. And we've tilted too much to the Israelis for the last 20, 30 years. We have to now try to consider the other side of the question. So that's it's totally the present. I'm not arguing that we shouldn't have recognized Israel. I'm not arguing that anything other than what happened was would have happened. Though, you know, again, when you look at history, there's all these little points at which something could have been different. But I'm not making an argument that there is one X solution that could have happened at that should have happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that brings us to the present. What is your what's your guess about what, you know, John Kerry, I guess to his credit, is pushing hard for something or other. But I personally, you know, actually a little, you want to hear a little John Kerry story?
Sure.
In 2011, I had just gotten back from Israel, and I had spent a fair amount of time in the West Bank. And I got on a plane in Boston or something, to Nantucket. And it was one of these small planes that holds maybe 20 people. So there's like no first class. So in a plane like this, you could find yourself sitting next to John Kerry, which I did. And this is 2011. And I was looking at a map of settlements. And he says, oh, you got a solution? And I said, actually, I came back convinced that it's too late for a two-state solution. And he didn't seem all that interested in that perspective, and he has remained uninterested in that perspective. But anyway, I don't seem to have had a major influence on his thinking. He's very aggressively pursuing a two-state solution. Do you think there's he has a prayer?
Well, look, here's what I'd say about Kerry, which is that if he had not become Secretary of State, I doubt very much the Obama administration would be doing anything there. It's very much to his credit that he's tried to do something. I think we could end up with a one-state solution, but my version of a one-state solution that is likely to happen is not one that I would desire. In other words, it would be an Israeli state with some minimal rights to the other two, to the Arab residents, and that's not something that I think we should press for.
Wait, say that again. The kind you would, I'm not sure I got that. The kind you would favor.
I think that politically, there has to be some kind of a transition, and so yes, I favor a two-state solution. I think it's going to be very hard to achieve. I think that in order for it to be successful, it would have to include political independence on the one hand, but economic integration. It couldn't be like Gaza. It couldn't be with a big separation wall and no Palestinians could work in Israel, because basically it would have to work like West and East Germany, where East Germany, you know, I mean, that would be marvelous. But what I'm saying is that there will have to be some way in which Palestinian standard of living would start to rise as a result of the integration with the Israeli economy. Because right now it's dependent on it, but dependent in a very bad way. Whether that's going to happen, though, is another question entirely. I think that there's issues like the status of Jerusalem that are presently making it very, very hard for me to see any kind of negotiation working. My 25-30% possibility right now.
That seems high to me.
Well, I know there's other people who give it even less, but I know that I have friends who say, well, it's just as well, you know, we don't that the negotiation could fail, because then you'll get a South Africa and there'll be demonstrations and stuff like that. Well, maybe there will be, and maybe after 30 or 40 years, you know, you'll get a one state like Truman wanted, but you could also in the meantime get a tremendous amount of bloodshed and unhappiness and terrorism and what have you. And I don't wish that upon anybody. So I would like to see this thing work. It's just going to be very, very hard.
But did I understand you correctly to say that you think the most likely long-term outcome is a one state solution? Although perhaps not the kind you would like, or?
Oh, no, I don't know what's likely.
Oh, okay.
I think that the most desirable would be, right now, would be for some kind of two-state thing to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I would even favor one that screws the Palestinians. I mean, I don't want to put it so boldly, but there's no, the things they're talking about are not good. I mean, having Israeli troops still in the Jordan Valley. I mean, but basically what they're preventing, what they're trying to prevent is the kind of unrest that the occupation created in the first place. So it's a kind of circular craziness involved.
To have Israeli troops in the new Palestine along the border with Jordan, not with Israel. Yeah, so... but wait, you should elaborate on one, you know, if you say you would accept one that screws the Palestinians. I think you should spell that out for your own good.
Well, here's what I'd say about it. You know, the Abba Eban statement about the Palestinians have never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity.
Right.
And, you know, he would refer to the UN partition, Camp David in 2000. You know, there are all these different instances. But if you look at all those instances, what they were rejecting were bad deals. And what could be said in retrospect, very truly, is they should have cut their losses then and they would have been better off. But they were losses. They were bad deals. And that's why the Palestinians rejected them. If they had been really good deals, it would be different. In 1947, they made up 70% of Palestine. The UN optimally was offering them 40%. Now, you know, that's not a good deal. And they ended up, in fact, with 78-22. It ended up 22%. So what I'm saying is that now, if they get any degree of political sovereignty, if they get that they can build on, and if the EU and the United States come in and help them, and if the Israelis don't block off the whole country and with a wall, then I think that they might be able to create something over the long term. Because the alternative to me of one state with continuation of riot, rebellion, terrorism would scare me much more. And it would be both against America's interests and against the interests of the people who live in Israel and Palestine right now.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by bad deal. I don't mean...
But there is also the question of, you know, isn't there such a thing as a deal that's so bad for the Palestinians that it doesn't leave them with enough dignity to forestall future violence, right?
Of course, and that's what the negotiations are about. And that's what Kerry and the people that are working with him have to be sensitive to. After 1948, the people who were involved in making concessions to the Jews, for instance, were assassinated. Jordan's king, Syria, the guy who was in charge in Syria. If Abbas and those people make a bad deal, there's going to be trouble. And so it might not work at all. So they have to do something. I'm agreeing with you that they have to make a deal that will create some kind of viable state. They can't allow something that will wall them off. They can't allow something that will allow no transit within the country itself without going through 16 checkpoints. So they have to have something with Jerusalem.
But it seems to me
an exact time limit if they concede, as Abbas seems to have done, that the Israeli army occupy along the Jordan River, there has to be a definite time limit on that. If there's not a definite time limit, then it's, you know.
Well, on that, his new proposal, possibly under the inspiration of Tom Friedman, I don't know, is to have NATO troops instead of Israeli troops.
Abbas agreed to that in negotiations with Olmert, the predecessor in 2008, mm-hmm. Netanyahu's predecessor. And they keep bringing that forward, but Netanyahu won't agree to that. So they have they keep putting that forward. It seems like that Abbas has given in on having Israeli troops there for five.
But that's what I mean. It seems like Abbas is giving in on so much that, again, it would not be viable in the end. I mean, in general, they discuss in these, you know, that you read about whenever it's...
To conclusions, though, Bob, because it's, you know, they could work it out. If it's a definite time limit, it's not the Jordan Valley, it's the Jordan River. And it could involve like 20 guys, you know, along a strip, a very narrow strip of the river. Or it could involve people patrolling all over the valley. If they're patrolling all over the valley, you have a continuation of the occupation.
Right. But it's not just that. It's not just that. Whenever we talk about what this state would be like, and this is true of Camp David, and I think it's true now, it's like, no, the Palestinians won't control their airspace. They won't control their borders. They'll never, ever be allowed to have a military. Well, that's not a state in the conventional sense of the term sovereign state. Sovereign states control their airspace. And it's one thing if there's a transitional period after which they would become a sovereign state, but I never hear about that as part of the talks. I don't hear Netanyahu ever saying, well, yeah, there would be a point after which they would have control their airspace, their borders, a military, any of that. So it just sounds to me like they're never actually discussing a real state.
They're discussing a semi-state. I'm not disagreeing with you. But they're starting from zero, and it's a question of whether they can get 40, 50 out of 100. So it's not the, and I think that's better than staying at zero. I don't disagree with you at all. It's very hard to imagine a state, for instance, having a foreign policy if they don't have their own airspace as army. So they would still remain, you could call them a dependency or something like that.
Yeah, and I'm not even getting all that moral or moralistic about it. I'm just saying as a practical matter, if you want to really solve the problem, I think you can't leave a lot of reasons for insurgencies to spring up, you know? I just think it's a mistake. That invites future violence. If you don't give them something that's actually like a state.
Well, the word again is like a state, and whether they can work out an agreement that the Palestinians accept, and that gives them some way of establishing their own government, mm-hmm. Having their own economy, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to have all the flaws that you describe, but the question is whether those flaws are fatal. I don't think that it won't work unless there is cooperation. I mean, the thing that's always cited is the distance between the West Bank and the Ben Gurion Airport. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you will have terrorists in, you know, a year who could knock out the Ben Gurion Airport from the West Bank. So they really have to make a deal that satisfies both sides, and that's what's tricky. That's what the Kerry people have to do. And again, my fear is that they won't give the Palestinians enough to do that. They're going to have to pressure Netanyahu. I don't know whether Obama's willing to do that. I think it's a matter of incurring a lot of strife and. Political hoopla and chaos, and you know that's going to happen if he pushes hard. But they're going to. I would hope they would. I just don't know whether they will.
Well, and remember, there's something else that Obama wants out of Netanyahu, which is to be only moderately troublesome on the Iran front. So you know, Obama may think of himself as choosing between a lasting nuclear deal with Iran and a two-state solution. And I think given how iffy a two-state solution would be in any event, if he thinks of it that way, he'll probably go with the Iran deal.
I have heard that the Palestinian negotiators are nervous about exactly that point.
As well they should be. So anything else about the book you want to say before we sign off? It's a substantial book. We cannot possibly have covered every important theme in it.
Well, the only thing that we didn't talk about that I take some pride in terms of the research is the history of American Zionism and what I found there. The American Zionists were like the people in Plato's cave, you know, in the Plato's Republic, where the people in the cave were seeing the shadows cast mm-hmm. on the wall.
Yeah.
Reality was outside the cave entirely. In the American Zionist movement starts in the 1890s. It's mainly a fundraising movement because the Jews in America didn't want to move to Palestine. They were perfectly happy in America, but they wanted to help the people of Palestine and the people of Europe who wanted to emigrate. but their views of what was actually going on there were largely the product of fundraisers who would come to the United States and give lecture tours. So they literally thought that it was a deserted place, that it was unoccupied.
A land without a people.
Yes, for a people
for
without
a people
a land.
Without a land.
Yeah, and you find that in all the literature, and especially before World War One, and the kind of moral compunctions that an American would have were resolved by these kind of illusions. Later, what I found was that the people who were the leaders of American Zionism, Rabbi Stephen Wise, Louis Brandeis, were on the one hand the most liberal Americans you could find. Wise was a founder of the ACLU, the NAACP, big supporter of labor unions. Brandeis, of course, everybody knows about. But they supported the most illiberal things when it came to Palestine itself. Brandeis goes to Roosevelt and talks about transferring the Arabs to Iraq as a solution to the conflict between the Arabs and Jews. That's how you could get a Jewish state. Reinhold Niebuhr, who was a kind of fellow traveler, a Christian but a supporter of Zionism, testifies in 1946, and he recommends the same thing, transferring a people.
Really?
Now, this is totally crazy to me because it's, you know, you've just lived through the World War II with the Nazis and transfer, and these guys are making these kind of proposals. So I think you find this kind of blindness about the Arab side of the question from the beginning of American Zionism. And
although it sounds like at the very beginning of American Zionism, they couldn't have been endorsing population transfer because they literally didn't realize there was
a population there. This is by the 1930s
right.
and 1940s.
Right.
In the beginning, it's more this idea that it's a deserted land and that the Jews are going to create a garden where a desert existed. Mm-hmm. But afterwards, it's the pilgrims versus the Indians. You get all the older views of America itself transferred to Palestine. And again, what I took out of that was that you find the same thing after World War II as well, and going up to the present. I mean, the people in AIPAC, for instance, are far more sophisticated about what's happening there. But I think that over the last 40, 50 years, they've shown a real indifference to the fate of the Arabs. And I think that's bad. I don't, as a Jew, it embarrasses me that people are so indifferent to the rights of another people. So that's the lesson I took from that history. The history of American Zionism.
Okay, and how are people reacting to that part of the message aside from the one review we just mentioned?
People have not asked me a lot about that part of the book. It's a third of the book, so we'll see. I mean, they mostly get fixed on on either the Truman part or what they seem to infer to be my views of the present.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it is early days. The book has not been out that long. Here is the book. John, is this your name in Hebrew or something? What is this up here?
It's Arabic, and the bottom is Hebrew, and I can't tell you whether it's...
Maybe it's Genesis in Hebrew and Genesis.
Oh, you mean it's at my name? It's Genesis, yes.
It's Genesis, okay.
That's what you were asking.
That's what I was asking.
Yes, that's what it is.
All right, and this is Truman. Okay, well, congratulations. Really... exhaustively researched, very nicely written, powerful narrative, and what else do you want in the way of a blurb? If you read only one book about Israel this week,
that's right.
Let this be the book.
Even if you don't read it, just buy it.
Buy it. If you say good things about only one book you haven't read, say them about this book. Okay. Well, thanks, John.
Thank you, Bob.
Okay. See you.